themselves more and more involved in the Olinka's problems. Nothing could be uglier than corrugated tin, Seeley. And as they struggled to put up roofs of this cold, hard, glittery, ugly metal, the women raised a deafening ululation of sorrow that echoed off the cavern walls for miles around. It was on this day that the Olinka acknowledged at least temporary defeat. Though the Olinka no longer ask anything of us beyond teaching their children, because they can see how powerless we and our God are, Samuel and I decided we must do something about this latest outrage, even as many of the people to whom we felt close ran away to join the Mbeles, or forest people, who live deep in the jungle, refusing to work for whites or be ruled by them. So off we went, with the children, to England. It was an incredible voyage, Seeley, not only because we had almost forgot about the rest of the world, and such things as ships and coal fires and street lights and oatmeal, but because on the ship with us was the white woman missionary whom we'd heard about years ago. She was now retired from missionary work and going back to England to live. She was traveling with a little African boy whom she introduced as her grandchild. Of course, it was impossible to ignore the presence of an aging white woman accompanied by a small black child. The ship was in a tither. Each day she and the child walked about the deck alone, groups of white people falling into silence as they passed. She is a jaunty, stringy, blue-eyed woman with hair the color of silver and dry grass, a short chin, and when she speaks, she seems to be gargling. "I'm pushing on for 65," she told us, when we found ourselves sharing a table for dinner one night. "Been in the tropics most of my life. But," she said, "a big war is coming, bigger than the one they were starting when I left. It'll go hard on England, but I expect we'll survive. I miss the other war," she said. "I mean to be present for this one." Samuel and I had never really thought about war. "Why," she said, "the signs are all over Africa. India, too, I expect. First, there's a road built to where you keep your goods. Then your trees are hauled off to make ships and captain's furniture. Then your land is planted with something you can't eat. Then you are forced to work it. That's happening all over Africa," she said. "Burma, too, I expect. But Harold here and I decided to get out. Didn't we, Harry?" she said, giving the little boy a biscuit. The child said nothing, just chewed his biscuit thoughtfully. Adam and Olivia soon took him off to explore the lifeboats. Doris's story, the woman's name is Doris Baines, is an interesting one, but I won't bore you with it as we eventually became bored. She was born to great wealth in England. Her father was Lord Somebody or Other. They were forever giving or attending parties that were no fun. Besides, she wanted to write books. Her family was against it, totally. They hoped she'd marry. "Me marry," she hooted. Really, she has the oddest ideas. "They did everything to convince me," she said. "You can't imagine. I never saw so many milk-fed young men in all my life as when I was 19 and 20. Each one more boring than the last. Can anything be more boring than an upper-class Englishman?" she said. "They remind one of bloody mushrooms." Well, she rattled on through endless dinners because the captain assigned us permanently to the same table. It seems the notion of becoming a missionary struck her one evening she was getting ready for yet another tedious date, and lay in the tub thinking a convent would be better than the castle in which she lived. She could think, she could write, she could be her own boss. But wait. As a nun, she would not be her own boss. God would be boss, the Virgin Mother, the Mother Superior, etc., etc. Ah, but a missionary, far off in the wilds of India, alone. It seemed like bliss. and so she cultivated a pious interest in heathens. Fooled her parents, fooled the missionary society, who were so taken with her quick command of languages, they sent her to Africa, worst luck, where she began writing novels about everything under the sun. "My pen name is Jarrett Hunt," she said. "In England and even in America, I'm a runaway success, rich, famous, an eccentric recluse who spends most of his time shooting wild game." "Well now," she continued several evenings later, "you don't think I paid much attention to the heathen. I saw nothing wrong with them as they were, and they seemed to like me well enough. I was actually able to help them a good deal. I was a writer, after all, and I wrote reams of paper in their behalf about their culture, their behavior, their needs, that sort of thing. You'd be surprised how good writing matters when you're going after money. I learned to speak their language faultlessly, and to throw off the missionary snoopers back at headquarters, I wrote entire reports in it. I tapped the family vaults for close on to £1 million before I got anything from the missionary societies or rich old family friends. I built a hospital, a grammar school, a college, a swimming pool, the one luxury I permitted myself, since swimming in the river one is subject to attack by leeches. You wouldn't believe the peace," she said at breakfast, halfway to England. "Within a year, everything, as far as me and the heathen were concerned, ran like clockwork. I told them right off that their souls were no concern of mine, that I wanted to write books and not be disturbed. For this pleasure, I was prepared to pay, rather handsomely. In a burst of appreciation one day, I'm afraid the chief, not knowing what else to do, no doubt, presented me with a couple of wives. I don't think it was commonly believed I was a woman. There seemed some question in their minds just what I was. Anyhow, I educated the two young girls as best I could, sent them to England, of course, to learn medicine and agriculture, welcomed them home when they returned, gave them away in marriage to two young chaps who were always about the place, and began the happiest period of my life as the grandmother of their children. I must say," she beamed, "I've turned out to be fab-o as a grandmama. I learned it from the Aquians. They never spank their children, never lock them away in another part of the hut. They do a bit of bloody cutting around puberty. But Harry's mother, the doctor, is going to change all that, isn't she, Harold?" "Anyway," she said, "when I get to England, I'll put a stop to their bloody encroachments. I'll tell them what to do with their bloody road and their bloody rubber plantations and their bloody sunburned but still bloody boring English planters and engineers. I am a very wealthy woman, and I own the village of Acqui." We listened to most of this in more or less respectful silence. The children were very taken with young Harold, though he never said a word in our presence. He seemed fond of his grandmother and used to her, but her verbosity produced in him a kind of soberly observant speechlessness. "He's quite different with us, though," said Adam, who is really a great lover of children and could get through to any child given half an hour. "Adam makes jokes, he sings, he clowns and knows games, and he has the sunniest smile most of the time, and great, healthy African teeth." As I write about his sunny smile, I realize he's been unusually glum during this trip, interested and excited, but not really sunny, except when he's with young Harold. I will have to ask Olivia what's wrong. She is thrilled at the thought of going back to England. Her mother used to tell her about the thatched cottages of the English and how they reminded her of the roof-leaf huts of the Olinka. "They are square, though," she'd say, "more like our church and school than like our homes," which Olivia thought very strange. When we reached England, Samuel and I presented the Olynkas' grievances to the bishop of the English branch of our church, a youngish man wearing spectacles, who sat thumbing through a stack of Samuel's yearly reports. Instead of even mentioning the Olynka, the bishop wanted to know how long it had been since Corrine's death, and why, as soon as she died, I had not returned to America. I really did not understand what he was driving at. "Appearances, miss," he said. "Appearances. What must the natives think?" "About what?" I asked. "Come, come," he said. "We behave as brother and sister to each other," said Samuel. The bishop smirked. "Yes, he did." I felt my face go hot. "Well, there was more of this, but why burden you with it? You know what some people are, and the bishop was one of them." Samuel and I left without even a word about the Olynkas' problems. Samuel was so angry, I was frightened. He said the only thing for us to do, if we wanted to remain in Africa, was join the Mbeles and encourage all the Olynka to do the same. "But suppose they do not want to go?" I asked. "Many of them are too old to move back into the forest. Many are sick. The women have small babies. And then there are the youngsters who want bicycles and British clothes, mirrors and shiny cooking pots. They want to work for the white people in order to have these things." "Things," he said in disgust. "Bloody things." "Well, we have a month here anyway," I said. "Let's make the most of it." Because we had spent so much of our money on the roofs and the voyage over, it had to be a poor man's month in England. But it was a very good time for us. We began to feel ourselves a family, without Corrine. And people meeting us on the street never failed, if they spoke to us at all, to express the sentiment that the children looked just like the two of us. The children began to accept this as natural, and began going out to view the sights that interested them alone, leaving their father and me to our quieter, more sedate pleasures, one of which was simple conversation. Samuel, of course, was born in the North, in New York, and grew up and was educated there. He met Corrine through his aunt, who had been a missionary, along with Corrine's aunt, in the Belgian Congo. Samuel frequently accompanied his Aunt Althea to Atlanta, where Corrine's Aunt Theodosia lived. "These two ladies had been through marvelous things together," said Samuel, laughing. "They'd been attacked by lions, stampeded by elephants, flooded out by rains, made war on by natives. The tales they told were simply incredible. There they sat, on a heavily antimacassared horsehair sofa, two prim and proper ladies in ruffles and lace, telling these stupendous stories over tea. Corrine and I, as teenagers, used to attempt to stylize these tales into comics. We called them such things as 3 months in a hammock, or sore hips of the dark continent, or a map of Africa, a guide to native indifference to the holy word. We made fun of them, but we were riveted on their adventures and on the ladies telling of them. They were so staid-looking, so proper. You really couldn't imagine them actually building with their own hands a school in the bush, or battling reptiles, or unfriendly Africans who thought, since they were wearing dresses with things that looked like wings behind, they should be able to fly. Bush, Corrine would snicker to me, or me to her. And just the sound of the word would send us off into quiet hysteria while we calmly sipped our tea. Because, of course, they didn't realize they were being funny. And to us they were, very. And, of course, the prevailing popular view of Africans at that time contributed to our feeling of amusement. Not only were Africans savages, they were bumbling, inept savages. rather like their bumbling, inept brethren at home. But we carefully, not to say studiously, avoided this very apparent connection. Corinne's mother was a dedicated housewife and mother who disliked her more adventurous sister. But she never prevented Corinne from visiting. And when Corinne was old enough, she sent her to Spelman Seminary, where Aunt Theodosia had gone. This was a very interesting place. It was started by two white missionaries from New England who used to wear identical dresses. Started in a church basement, it soon moved up to army barracks. Eventually, these two ladies were able to get large sums of money from some of the richest men in America, and so the place grew. Buildings, trees. Girls were taught everything. Reading, writing, arithmetic, sewing, cleaning, cooking. But more than anything else, they were taught to serve God and the colored community. Their official motto was, "Our whole school for Christ." But I always thought their unofficial motto should have been, "Our community covers the world." Because no sooner had a young woman got through Spelman Seminary than she began to put her hand to whatever work she could do for her people, anywhere in the world. It was truly astonishing. These very polite and proper young women, some of them never having set foot outside their own small country towns except to come to the seminary, thought nothing of packing up for India, Africa, the Orient, or to Philadelphia or New York. 60 years or so before the founding of the school, the Cherokee Indians who lived in Georgia were forced to leave their homes and walk through the snow to resettlement camps in Oklahoma. A third of them died on the way, but many of them refused to leave Georgia. They hid out as colored people and eventually blended with us. Many of these mixed-race people were at Spelman. Some remembered who they actually were, but most did not. If they thought about it at all, and it became harder to think about Indians because there were none around, they thought they were yellow or reddish-brown and wavy-haired because of white ancestors, not Indian. "Even Corinne thought this," he said. "And yet, I always felt her Indianness. She was so quiet, so reflective, and she could erase herself, her spirit, with a swiftness that truly startled when she knew the people around her could not respect it." It did not seem hard for Samuel to talk about Corinne while we were in England. It wasn't hard for me to listen. "It all seems so improbable," he said. "Here I am, an aging man whose dreams of helping people have been just that, dreams." How Corinne and I as children would have laughed at ourselves. 20 years, a fool of the West, or mouth and roof leaf disease, a treatise on futility in the tropics, etc., etc. "We failed so utterly," he said. "We became as comical as Althea and Theodosia. I think her awareness of this fueled Corinne's sickness. She was far more intuitive than I. Her gift for understanding people, much greater. She used to say the Olinka resented us. But I wouldn't see it. But they do, you know." "No," I said, "it isn't resentment, exactly. It really is indifference. Sometimes I feel our position is like that of flies on an elephant's hide." "I remember once, before Corinne and I were married," Samuel continued, "Aunt Theodosia had one of her at-homes. She had them every Thursday. She'd invited a lot of serious young people, as she called them, and one of them was a young Harvard scholar named Edward. Du Bois was his last name, I think. Anyhow, Aunt Theodosia was going on about her African adventures, leading up to the time King Leopold of Belgium presented her with a medal. Well, Edward, or perhaps his name was Bill, was a very impatient sort. You saw it in his eyes. You could see it in the way he moved his body. He was never still. As Aunt Theodosia got closer to the part about her surprise and joy over receiving this medal, which validated her service as an exemplary missionary in the King's colony, Du Bois's foot began to pat the floor rapidly and uncontrollably. Corrine and I looked at each other in alarm. Clearly this man had heard this tale before and was not prepared to endure it a second time. "Madam," he said, when Aunt Theodosia finished her story and flashed her famous medal around the room, "do you realize King Leopold cut the hands off workers who, in the opinion of his plantation overseers, did not fulfill their rubber quota? Rather than cherish that medal, madam, you should regard it as a symbol of your unwitting complicity with this despot who worked to death and brutalized and eventually exterminated thousands and thousands of African peoples." "Well," said Samuel, "silence struck the gathering like a blight. Poor Aunt Theodosia. There's something in all of us that wants a medal for what we have done, that wants to be appreciated. And Africans certainly don't deal in medals. They hardly seem to care whether missionaries exist." "Don't be bitter," I said. "How can I not?" he said. "The Africans never ask us to come, you know. There's no use blaming them if we feel unwelcome." "It's worse than unwelcome," said Samuel. "The Africans don't even see us. They don't even recognize us as the brothers and sisters they sold." "Oh, Samuel," I said, "don't." But you know, he had started to cry. "Oh, Nettie," he said, "that's the heart of it, don't you see? We love them. We try every way we can to show that love. But they reject us. They never even listen to how we've suffered. And if they listen, they say stupid things. 'Why don't you speak our language?' they ask. 'Why can't you remember the old ways? Why aren't you happy in America if everyone there drives motor cars?' Seely, it seemed as good a time as any to put my arms around him, which I did. And words long buried in my heart crept to my lips. I stroked his dear head and face, and I called him darling and dear. And I'm afraid, dear, dear Seely, that concern and passion soon ran away with us. I hope when you receive this news of your sister's forward behavior, you will not be shocked or inclined to judge me harshly, especially when I tell you what a total joy it was. I was transported by ecstasy in Samuel's arms. You may have guessed that I loved him all along, but I did not know it. Oh, I loved him as a brother and respected him as a friend, but Seely, I love him bodily as a man. I love his walk, his size, his shape, his smell, the kinkiness of his hair. I love the very texture of his palms, the pink of his inner lip. I love his big nose. I love his brows. I love his feet. And I love his dear eyes, in which the vulnerability and beauty of his soul can be plainly read." The children saw the change in us immediately. "I'm afraid, my dear, we were radiant." "We love each other dearly," Samuel told them, with his arm around me. "We intend to marry." "But before we do," I said, "I must tell you something about my life and about Corrine and about someone else." And it was then I told them about you, Seely, and about their mother Corrine's love of them and about being their aunt. "But where is this other woman, your sister?" asked Olivia. I explained your marriage to Mister as best I could. Adam was instantly alarmed. He is a very sensitive soul who hears what isn't said as clearly as what is. "We will go back to America soon," said Samuel to reassure him, "and see about her. The children stood up with us in a simple church ceremony in London. And it was that night, after the wedding dinner, when we were all getting ready for bed, that Olivia told me what has been troubling her brother. He is missing Tashi. "But he's also very angry with her," she said, "because when we left, she was planning to scar her face." I didn't know this. One of the things we thought we'd help stop was the scarring or cutting of tribal marks on the faces of young women. "It is a way the Olinka can show they still have their own ways," said Olivia, "even though the white man has taken everything else. Tashi didn't want to do it, but to make her people feel better, she's resigned. She's going to have the female initiation ceremony, too," she said. "Oh, no," I said. "That's so dangerous. Suppose she becomes infected." "I know," said Olivia. "I told her, nobody in America or Europe cuts off pieces of themselves. And anyway, she should have had it when she was 11, if she was going to have it. She's too old for it now." "Well, some men are circumcised," I said, "but that's just the removal of a bit of skin." "Tashi was happy that the initiation ceremony isn't done in Europe or America," said Olivia. "That makes it even more valuable to her." "I see," I said. "She and Adam had an awful fight. Not like any they've had before. He wasn't teasing her or chasing her around the village or trying to tie roofleaf twigs in her hair. He was mad enough to strike her." "Well, it's a good thing he didn't," I said. "Tashi would have jammed his head through her rug loom." "I'll be glad when we get back home," said Olivia. "Adam isn't the only one who misses Tashi." She kissed me and her father goodnight. Adam soon came in to do the same. "Mama Nettie," he said, sitting on the bed next to me, "how do you know when you really love someone?" "Sometimes you don't know," I said. "He is a beautiful young man, Celie, tall and broad-shouldered, with a deep, thoughtful voice. Did I tell you he writes verses and loves to sing? He's a son to make you proud. Your loving sister, Nettie. P.S. Your brother Samuel sends his love as well." Dearest Celie, when we returned home, everyone seemed happy to see us. When we told them our appeal to the church and the missionary society failed, they were disappointed. They literally wiped the smiles off their faces along with the sweat and returned dejected to their barracks. We went on to our building, a combination church, house, and school, and began to unpack our things. The children, I realize I shouldn't call them children, they're grown, went in search of Tashi. An hour later, they returned dumbfounded. They discovered no sign of her. Catherine, her mother, is planting rubber trees some distance from the compound, they were told. But no one had seen Tashi all day. Olivia was very disappointed. Adam was trying to appear unconcerned, but I noticed he was absent-mindedly biting the skin around his nails. After 2 days, it became clear that Tashi was deliberately hiding. Her friend said while we were away, she'd undergone both the facial scarification ceremony and the rite of female initiation. Adam went quite gray at this news. Olivia merely stricken and more concerned than ever to find her. It was not until Sunday that we saw Tashi. She'd lost a considerable amount of weight and seemed listless, dull-eyed, and tired. Her face was still swollen from half a dozen small, neat incisions high on each cheek. When she put out her hand to Adam, he refused to take it. He just looked at her scars, turned on his heel, and left. She and Olivia hugged, but it was a quiet, heavy embrace. Nothing like the boisterous, giggling behavior I expect from them. Tashi is, unfortunately, ashamed of these scars on her face. and now hardly ever raises her head. They must be painful, too, because they look irritated and red. But this is what the villagers are doing to the young women and even the men, carving their identification as a people into their children's faces. But the children think of scarification as backward, something from their grandparents' generation, and often resist. So the carving is done by force, under the most appalling conditions. We provide antiseptics and cotton and a place for the children to cry and nurse their wounds. Each day Adam presses us to leave for home. He can no longer bear living as we do. There aren't even any trees near us, just giant boulders and smaller rocks. And more of his companions are running away. The real reason, of course, is he can no longer bear his conflicting feelings about Tashi, who is beginning, I think, to appreciate the magnitude of her mistake. Samuel and I are truly happy, Seeley, and so grateful to God that we are. We still keep a school for the littlest children. Those 8 and over are already workers in the fields. In order to pay rent for the barracks, taxes on the land, and to buy water and wood and food, everyone must work. So we teach the young ones, babysit the babies, look after the old and sick, and attend birthing mothers. Our days are fuller than ever, our sojourn in England already a dream. But all things look brighter because I have a loving soul to share them with. Your sister, Nettie. Dearest Nettie, the man us knowed as Pa is dead. How come you still call him Pa? Shug asked me the other day. But too late to call him Alfonso. I never even remember Ma calling him by his name. She always said, "Yo, Pa." I reckon to make us believe it better. Anyhow, his little wife Daisy called me up on the telephone in the middle of the night. "Miss Seeley," she say, "I got bad news. Alfonso dead." "Who?" I asked. "Alfonso," she say, "your stepdaddy." "How he die?" I asked. "I think of killing, being hit by a truck, struck by lightning, lingering disease." But she said, "No, he died in his sleep." "Well, not quite in his sleep," she say. "Us was spending a little time in bed together, you know, before us drop off." "Well," I say, "you have my sympathy." "Yes, ma'am," she say, "and I thought I had this house too, but looked like it belonged to your sister Nettie and you." "Say what?" I asked. "Your stepdaddy been dead over a week," she say. "When us went to town to hear the will read yesterday, you could have knocked me over with a feather. Your real daddy owned the land and the house and the store. He left it to your mama. When your mama died, it passed on to you and your sister Nettie. I don't know why Alfonso never told you that." "Well," I say, "anything coming from him, I don't want it." I hear Daisy suck in her breath. "How about your sister Nettie?" she say. "You think she feel the same way?" I wake up a little bit then. By the time Shug roll over and ask me who it is, I'm beginning to see the light. "Don't be a fool," Shug say, nudging me with her foot. "You got your own house now. Your dad and mama left it for you. That dog of a stepdaddy just a bad odor passing through." "But I never had no house," I say. "Just to think about having my own house enough to scare me. Plus this house I'm getting is bigger than Shug's. Got more land around it, and it come with a store." "My God," I say to Shug, "me and Nettie own a dry goods store. What us gonna sell?" "How about pants?" she say. So us hung up the phone and rushed down home again to look at the property. About a mile before us got to town, us come up on the entrance to the colored cemetery. Shug was sound asleep, but something told me I ought to drive in. Pretty soon I see something look like a short skyscraper, and I stop the car and go up to it. Sure enough, it's got Alfonso's name on it. Got a lot of other stuff on it, too. Member of this and that. Leading businessman and farmer. Upright husband and father. Kind to the poor and helpless. He been dead 2 weeks, but fresh flowers still blooming on his grave. Should get out the car and come stand by me. Finally, she yawned loud and stretched herself. The son of a bitch still dead, she said. Daisy tried to act like she glad to see us, but she not. She got too cheering and looked pregnant with one more. But she got nice clothes, a car, and Alfonso left her all his money. Plus, I think she managed to set her folks up while she lived with him. She says, Celie, the old house you remember was torn down so Alfonso could build this one. He got an Atlanta architect to design it, and these tiles come all the way from New York. We were standing in the kitchen at the time, but he put tiles everywhere, kitchen, toilet, back porch, all around the fireplaces and back and front parlor. But this the house go with the place right on, she say. Of course I did take the furniture, because Alfonso bought it special for me. Fine with me, I say. I can't get over having a house. Soon as Daisy leave me with the keys, I run from one room to another like I'm crazy. Look at this, I say to Shug. Look at that. She look, she grin. She hugged me whenever she gets a chance, and I stand still. You doing all right, Miss Celie, she say. God know where you live. Then she took some cedar sticks out of her bag and lit them and gave one of them to me. Us started at the very top of the house in the attic, and us smoked it all the way down to the basement, chasing out all the evil and making a place for good. Oh, Nettie, us have a house. A house big enough for us and our children, for your husband and Shug. Now you can come home, 'cause you have a home to come to. Your loving sister, Celie. Dear Nettie, my heart broke. Shug loved somebody else. Maybe if I had stayed in Memphis last summer, it never would have happened. But I spent the summer fixing up the house. I thought if you come any time soon, I want it to be ready. And it is real pretty now and comfortable. And I found me a nice lady to live in it and look after it. Then I come home to Shug. Miss Celie, she say, how would you like some Chinese food to celebrate your coming home? I love Chinese food, so off us go to the restaurant. I'm so excited about being home again, I don't even notice how nervous Shug is. She a big, graceful woman most of the time, even when she mad. But I notice she can't get her chopsticks to work right. She knock over her glass of water. Somehow or another, her egg roll come unravel. But I think she just so glad to see me, so I preen and pose for her, and stuff myself with wonton soup and fried rice. Finally, the fortune cookies come. I love fortune cookies. They're so cute. And I read my fortune right away. It say, because you are who you are, the future look happy and bright. I laugh, pass it on to Shug. She look at it and smile. I feel at peace with the world. Shug pull her slip of paper out real slow, like she's scared of what might be on it. Well, I say, watching her read it, what'd it say? She look down at it, look up at me. Say, it say I got the hots for a boy of 19. Let me see, I say, laughing. And I read it out loud. A burnt finger, remember the fire, it say. I'm trying to tell you, Shug say. Trying to tell me what? I'm so dense it still don't penetrate. But one thing, it been a long time since I thought about boys, and I ain't never thought about men. Last year, say Shug, I hired a new man to work in the band. I almost didn't, because he can't play nothing but flute. And who ever heard a blues flute? I hadn't. The very notion sound crazy. But it was just my luck that blues flute is the one thing blues music been lacking, and the minute I heard Germaine play, I knew this for a fact. Germaine? I asked. Yeah, she said, Germaine. I don't know who give him that flittish name, but it suit him. Then she start right in to rave about this boy. Like all his good points have to be stuff I'm dying to hear. Oh, she say, he little, he cute, got nice buns, you know, real Bantu. She so used to telling me everything, she rattled on and on, getting more excited and in love looking by the minute. By the time she finished talking about his neat little dancing feet and get back up to his honey brown curly hair, I feel like shit. Hold it, I say. Shug, you're killing me. She halt in mid-praise. Her eyes fill with tears and her face crumple. Oh, God, Celia, she say, I'm so sorry. I just been dying to tell somebody, and you to somebody I usually tell. Well, I say, if words could kill, I'd be in the ambulance. She put her face in her hands and started to cry. Celia, she say, through her fingers, I still love you. But I just sit there and watch her. Seem like all my wonton soup turned to ice. Why are you so upset? She asked, when us got back home. You never seem to get upset about Grady, and he was my husband. Grady never bring no sparkle to your eye, I think, but I don't say nothing. I'm too far away. Course, she say, Grady's so dull, Jesus. And when you finish talking about women and reefer, you finish Grady. But still, she say, I don't say nothing. She tried to laugh. I was so glad he lit out after Mary Agnes, I didn't know what to do, she say. I don't know who tried to teach him what to do in the bedroom, but it must have been a furniture salesman. I don't say nothing. Stillness, coolness, nothingness, coming fast. You notice when they left here together going to Panama, I didn't shed a tear? But now really, she say, what they gonna look like in Panama? Poor Mary Agnes, I think. How could anybody guess old Dull Grady would end up running a reefer plantation in Panama? Course, they making bukus of money, say Shug. And Mary Agnes outdress everybody down there, the way she tell it in her letters. And at least Grady let her sing, what little snatches of her song she can still remember. But really, she say, Panama. Where is it at, anyhow? Is it down there round Cuba? Us ought to go to Cuba, Miss Celia, you know. Lots of gambling there and good times. Lots of colored folks look like Mary Agnes. Some real black, like us. All in the same family, though. Try to pass for white. Somebody mention your grandma. I don't say nothing. I pray to die. Just so I don't never have to speak. All right, says Shug. It started when you was down home. I missed you, Celia. And you know, I'm a high-natured woman. I went and got a piece of paper that I was using for cutting patterns. I wrote her a note. It said, shut up. But Celia, she said, I have to make you understand. Look, she said, I'm getting old. I'm fat. Nobody think I'm good looking no more but you. Or so I thought. He's 19, a baby. How long can it last? He's a man, I write on the paper. Yeah, she said, he is. And I know how you feel about men, but I don't feel that way. I would never be fool enough to take any of them seriously, she say. But some men's can be a lots of fun. Spare me, I write. Celia, she say, all I ask is 6 months, Just 6 months to have my last fling. I got to have it, Celie. I'm too weak a woman not to. But if you just give me 6 months, Celie, I will try to make our life together like it was. Not hardly, I write. Celie, she say, do you love me? She down on her knees by now, tears falling all over the place. My heart hurts so much, I can't believe it. How can it keep beating, feeling like this? But I'm a woman. I love you, I say. Whatever happened, whatever you do, I love you. She whimper a little, lean her head against my chair. Thank you, she say. But I can't stay here, I say. But Celie, she say, how can you leave me? You're my friend. I love this child, and I'm scared to death. He's a third of my age, a third of my size, even a third of my color. She tried to laugh again. You know he gonna hurt me worse than I'm hurting you. Don't leave me, please. Just then the doorbell rang. Shug wiped her face and went to answer it, saw who it was and kept on out the door. Soon, I heard a car drive off. I went on up to bed. But sleep remain a stranger to this night. Pray for me. Your sister, Celie. Dear Nettie, the only thing keep me alive is watching Henrietta fight for her life. And boy, can she fight. Every time she have an attack, she scream enough to wake the dead. Us do what you say the peoples do in Africa. Us feed her yams every single day. Just our luck, she hate yams, and she not too polite to let us know. Everybody for miles around try to come up with yam dishes that don't taste like yams. Us get plates of yam eggs, yam chitlins, yam goat, and soup. My God, folks be making soup out of everything but shoe leather, trying to kill off the yam taste. But Henrietta claims she still tastes it, and is likely to throw whatever it is out the window. Us tell her in a little while she'll have 3 months not to eat yams, but she say that day don't seem like it ever want to come. Meanwhile, her joints all swole, she hot enough to burn. She say her head feel like it's full of little white men with hammers. Sometime I meet up with Mister visiting Henrietta. He dream up his own little sneaky recipes. For instance, one time he hid yams in peanut butter. Us sit by the fire with Harpo and Sophia and play a hand or two of Bidwist, while Susie Q and Henrietta listen to the radio. Sometime he drive me home in his car. He still live in the same little house. He been there so long, it looked just like him. Two straight chairs always on the porch, turned against the wall. Porch railings with flower cans on them. He keep it painted now, though, fresh and white. And guess what he collect just 'cause he liked them? He collect shells, all kinds of shells, terrapin, snail, and all kinds of shells from the sea. Matter of fact, that's how he got me up to the house again. He was telling Sophia about some new shell he had that made a loud sea sound when you put it to your ear. Us went up to see it. It was big and heavy and speckled like a chicken, and sure enough, seemed like you could hear the waves or something crashing against your ear. None of us ever seen the ocean, but missed to learn about it from books. He ordered shells from books, too, and they all over the place. He don't say that much about them while you're looking, but he hold each one like it just arrived. Shug one time had a seashell, he say, long time ago, when us first met. Big white thing, looked like a fan. She still love shells? He asked. No, I say, she love elephants now. He wait a little while, put all the shells back in place. Then he asked me, you like any special thing? I love birds, I say. You know, he say. You used to remind me of a bird. Way back when you first come to live with me, you was so skinny, Lord, he say. And the least little thing happened, you looked about to fly away. You saw that, I say. I saw it, he said. Just too big a fool to let myself care. Well, I say, us lived through it. We still man and wife, you know, he say. Naw, I say, we never was. You know, he say, you look real good since you been up in Memphis. Yeah, I say, Shug take good care of me. How you make your living up there, he say. Making pants, I say. He say, I notice everybody in the family just about wearing pants you made. But you mean you turned it into a business? That's right, I say. But I really started it right here in your house to keep from killing you. He looked down at the floor. Shug helped me make the first pair I ever did, I say. And then, like a fool, I start to cry. He say, Celie, tell me the truth. You don't like me 'cause I'm a man? I blow my nose. Take off their pants, I say, and men look like frogs to me. No matter how you kiss 'em, as far as I'm concerned, frogs is what they stay. I see, he say. By the time I got back home, I was feeling so bad, I couldn't do nothing but sleep. I tried to work on some new pants I'm trying to make for pregnant women. But just the thought of anybody getting pregnant make me want to cry. Your sister, Celie. Dear Nettie, the only piece of mail Mr. ever put directly in my hand is a telegram that come from the United States Department of Defense. It say the ship you and the children and your husband left Africa in was sunk by German mines off the coast of some place called Gibraltar. They think you all drowned. Plus, the same day, all the letters I wrote to you over the years come back unopened. I sit here in this big house by myself trying to sew. But what good is sewing gonna do? What good is anything? Being alive began to seem like an awful strain. Your sister, Celie. Dearest Celie, Tashi and her mother have run away. They have gone to join the Mbeles. Samuel and the children and I were discussing it just yesterday, and we realized we do not even know for sure the Mbeles exist. All we know is that they are said to live deep in the forest, that they welcome runaways, and that they harass the white man's plantations and plan his destruction, or at least for his removal from their continent. Adam and Olivia are heartbroken because they love Tashi and miss her, and because no one who has gone to join the Mbeles ever returned. We try to keep them busy around the compound, and because there is so much sickness from malaria this season, there's plenty for them to do. In plowing under the Olinka's yam crop and substituting canned and powdered goods, the planters destroyed what makes them resistant to malaria. Of course they did not know this. They only wanted to take the land for rubber. But the Olinka have been eating yams to prevent malaria and to control chronic blood disease for thousands and thousands of years. Left without a sufficient supply of yams, the people, what's left of them, are sickening and dying at an alarming rate. To tell you the truth, I fear for our own health and especially for the children. But Samuel feels we will probably be all right, having had bouts with malaria during the first years we were here. And how are you, dearest sister? Nearly 30 years have passed without a word between us. For all I know, you may be dead. As the time nears for us to come home, Adam and Olivia ask endless questions about you, few of which I can answer. Sometimes I tell them, Tashi reminds me of you. And because there's no one finer to them than Tashi, they glow with delight. But will you still have Tashi's honest and open spirit, I wonder, when we see you again? Or will years of childbearing and abuse from Mista have destroyed it? These are thoughts I don't pursue with the children, only with my beloved companion, Samuel, who advises me not to worry, to trust in God, and to have faith in the sturdiness of my sister's soul. God is different to us now after all these years in Africa, more spirit than ever before, and more internal. Most people think he has to look like something or someone, a roof leaf or Christ, but we don't. And not being tied to what God looks like frees us. When we return to America, we must have long talks about this, Seeley. And perhaps Samuel and I will found a new church in our community that has no idols in it whatsoever, in which each person's spirit is encouraged to seek God directly. His belief that this is possible strengthened by us as people who also believe. There is little to do here for entertainment, as you can imagine. We read the papers and magazines from home, play any number of African games with the children, rehearse the African children in parts of Shakespeare's plays. Adam was always very good as Hamlet, giving his to be or not to be soliloquy. Corinne had firm notions of what the children should be taught, and saw to it that every good work advertised in the papers became part of their library. They know many things, and I think will not find American society such a shock, except for the hatred of black people, which is also very clear in all the news. But I worry about their very African independence of opinion and outspokenness, also extreme self-centeredness. And we will be poor, Seeley. And it will be years, no doubt, before we even own a home. How will they manage the hostility towards them, having grown up here? When I think of them in America, I see them as much younger than they appear here, much more naive. The worst we have had to endure here is indifference and a certain understandable shallowness in our personal relationships, excluding our relationship with Catherine and Tashi. After all, the Olinka know we can leave. They must stay. And of course, none of this has to do with color. And, dearest Seeley, last night I stopped writing because Olivia came in to tell me Adam is missing. He can only have gone after Tashi. Pray for his safety. Your sister, Nettie. Dearest Nettie, sometimes I think Suge never loved me. I stand looking at my naked self in the looking glass. What would she love? I ask myself. My hair is short and kinky because I don't straighten it anymore. Once Suge says she love it, no need to. My skin dark. My nose, just a nose. My lips, just lips. My body, just any woman's body going through the changes of age. Nothing special here for nobody to love. No honey-colored curly hair. No cuteness. Nothing young and fresh. My heart must be young and fresh, though. It feel like it blooming blood. I talk to myself a lot, standing in front the mirror. Seeley, I say, happiness was just a trick in your case. Just 'cause you never had any before Suge, you thought it was time to have some, and that it was gonna last. Even thought you had the trees with you, the whole earth, the stars. But look at you. When Suge left, happiness dessert. Every once in a while, I get a postcard from Suge. Her and Jermaine in New York, in California,